vote, because if I don't get Iowa, I won't believe that one. I may never have to come back here again if I don't get Iowa. I'll never be back. You understand that, Kim?
That's Kim Jong-un, is the Kim he's referring to. They're doing some campaign events together. This guy, I know we know he's nuts, but he is nuts. No one in my lifetime has done more to separate us, to drive us apart, than Donald Trump. And yet, he genuinely believes he deserved to win the Nobel Prize for Peace.
Told our First Lady, darling, we're going to have the greatest publicity I've ever had tonight. I got nominated for the Nobel Prize. Do you know what that is, darling? Let's go home. So I leave for the first time in a long time early. I get home. I turn on the television. They talked about your floods in Iowa. They talked about how's Iowa doing the crops? How's this happening? How are they doing in Florida? Three, four stories, one after another. Where's my Nobel Peace Prize they don't talk about?
That's right. F you, Iowa, with your floods and your crops. I told Melania I was going to win a Nobel Prize.
With President Trump down by a wide margin in the latest polls, his campaign has landed on a closing argument, spread coronavirus to as many people as possible, and threatened to leave the country if he loses.
In the run-up to the election, Trump is planning to hold 2 to 3 events per day. Brilliant! Be on TV every second to remind Americans why they can't stand looking at you anymore. At a rally in Georgia on Friday, Trump openly mused about losing.
Could you imagine if I lose my whole life? What am I going to do? I'm going to say, I lost to the worst candidate in the history of politics. I'm not going to feel so good. Maybe I'll have to leave the country.
I'll help you pack. I hear Equatorial Guinea has a beautiful no extradition treaty this time of year. Now, one of Trump's biggest problems is that suburban women in battleground states don't like him. To which Trump responded, yes, you do, and yes, you will.
The women who they say don't like me, they actually do like me a lot.
No surprise there. Trump's got a long history of ignoring women saying, I'm not that into you. And he ain't too proud to beg, sweet darling.
Suburban women, please vote for me. Suburban women, will you please like me?
Please clap.
2 weeks left in the campaign, and he's starting to sound like late 70s Woody Allen. Suburban women don't like me very much.
Trump is also being hurt by his total shanking of the pandemic, and things are getting worse. On Friday, for the first time since July, the United States reported over 70,000 coronavirus cases, and one expert predicts that the next 6 to 12 weeks are going to be the darkest of the entire pandemic. In other words,
the worst is yet to come.
We're now heading into a third wave of the coronavirus pandemic, which scientists are warning could be the worst yet, and Trump is doing nothing. He's letting a deadly virus rip through the country unabated. Worse, he seems like he's doing everything he can to spread the disease after appearing to catch it himself at a White House super spreader event, and even acting like it was a good thing, calling it a blessing from God, suggesting he's immune now, and that he feels powerful like Superman, when, if anything, he has the grammar and syntax of Bizarro. Women suburban like no Bizarro. At that same Florida event, as hundreds of Americans die every day and 10 states recorded record high COVID cases, Trump once again told seniors that the virus was on the verge of disappearing.
The light at the end of the tunnel is near. We are rounding the turn. I say that all the time. Some of the media doesn't like hearing it, but I say it all the time. We're rounding that turn.
You've been saying that for months. If you're always rounding the turn, then you're actually just going in circles.
Rounding around and around. Rounding around and around. Rounding around and around and around and around.
Oh, stop the world and let me on. I'm tired of going round and round.
Today, Trump stopped by Arizona for another super spreader rally. And he insisted that this whole pandemic thing is just a passing fad.
Your state is doing great with a pandemic. Pandemic. They're getting tired of the pandemic, aren't they? Getting tired of the pandemic. You turn on CNN, that's all they cover. COVID, COVID, pandemic, COVID, COVID, COVID. You know why? They're trying to talk everybody out of voting. People aren't buying at CNN, you dumb bastards. They're not buying it.
Trump then bragged about his own recovery.
That's great. That's great. But I took it and it was incredible. Incredible. And I was out. I took it. I felt like Superman. The next morning I woke up. I said, let me at him.
Ah, yes. Exactly like Superman. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's a crazy guy jacked up on steroids. Truth, justice, and the American let me at him. Trump keeps insisting COVID is nothing to worry about.
It's ending anyway. I mean, they go crazy when I say it. It's going to peter out, and it's going to end.
We're rounding the turn.
We're rounding the corner.
The light at the end of the tunnel is near.
Nothing says you're out of danger like go toward the light. We're going to put all the COVID into a bucket, and then we're going to kick the bucket all the way to that farm upstate. We're all going to live as live as doornails.
Trump keeps going from state to state, holding super spreader rallies where people are tightly packed in without masks or social distancing. Even in states experiencing surges and hospitalizations and caseloads like Wisconsin, he keeps spreading lies about masks, and his events have repeatedly been linked to outbreaks from Tulsa to Minnesota. Just today, he once again attacked the nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, calling him a disaster. At this point, it's impossible to conclude anything other than the fact that Trump and his allies are actively trying to get people sick. What more could he be doing at this point? Letting people crowd surf at his rallies? Check. And then chucking hats you touched into the crowd right before testing positive for COVID? Check. Soon he's going to travel with a mascot named COVID Larry. He'll hand out kisses to whoever cheers the loudest. That's the story most voters are laser focused on. The president and his party are actively getting people sick. Trump and the GOP clearly do not care how many Americans die from this disease. They're more upset about Facebook and Twitter not letting them spread obvious bull about a New York Post story. Even the Post's own reporters didn't want to put their names on. The out-of-control pandemic that is once again spiking across the country and the economic misery that comes with it are the stories that matter most. And Trump and the GOP can't just talk them away no matter how hard they try. That's why they're unraveling, inciting violence against their opponents and spinning wild conspiracy theories. So over the last few days, Trump has repeatedly called for Joe Biden, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, to be thrown in jail even after a right-wing terrorist plot to kidnap Whitmer was uncovered.
You know, Biden wants to lock it down. He wants to listen to Dr. Fauci. He wants to listen to Dr. Fauci.
Dr. Fauci is the most trusted person on coronavirus in the United States. I don't think that's the attack you think it is. And I'm being told there's already a new ad.
You know, Biden wants to lock it down. He wants to listen to Dr. Fauci.
I'm Joe Biden, and I approve this message.
Last night, the same Dr. Fauci was on 60 Minutes, and he was frank about Trump's efforts to keep him from speaking to the public.
During this pandemic, has the White House been controlling when you can speak with the media?
You know, I think you'd have to be honest to say yes. I certainly have not been allowed to go on many, many, many shows that have asked for me.
Fauci was also concerned about the president personally.
Were you surprised that President Trump got sick?
Absolutely not. I was worried that he was going to get sick when I saw him in a completely precarious situation of crowded, no separation between people, and almost nobody wearing a mask. When I saw that on TV, I said, oh my goodness. Nothing good can come out of that. That's got to be a problem.
So, Fauci influences Trump's COVID policy the same way we do, by staring in horror at the TV and saying, that's got to be a problem. Today, with infections spiking across the country, Trump hit back at Fauci on a campaign staff phone call with reporters, saying, people are tired of hearing Fauci and these idiots. Oh, these idiots who got it wrong. Yeah, remember the idiot who said it would go away in April? According to polls, people are really tired of that guy.
The reason they're trying to slime the Bidens is because they can't actually talk about Trump's horrendous record. And now, with 2 weeks until the election, as millions of people line up to vote early and Biden widens his lead in national polls, the president has been as erratic as ever. He's concocting a harebrained scheme with his Italian Dracula lawyer to spread disinformation about the Biden family, calling for political opponents to be thrown in jail, inciting violence against the governor of Michigan, laying the groundwork for a sequel to Bush v. Gore, begging suburban women to like him, threatening to leave the country if he loses, suggesting on Twitter that Biden had the members of SEAL Team 6 murdered after failing to kill Osama bin Laden, who is, according to this theory, still alive, and claiming the military has some sort of secret aquatic weapon.
Everybody is envious. We have the hydrosonic missiles that you used to hear about. We didn't have them because other countries were stealing our plans from the Obama administration. But we now have hydrosonic missiles.
Are you sure you don't mean hypersonic? Not hydrosonic? Are you confusing the U.S. military with Aquaman?
We have hypersonic missiles, folks. They can talk to dolphins, fish. That's how we recruited the Navy SEALs.
We're watching a deeply dangerous man, supported by a deeply dangerous party, unravel at the prospect of losing power. They don't seem to care who they hurt or who gets sick in the process, but it's in our power to stop him by voting to repudiate him in overwhelming numbers. And if we succeed, this time next year, he'll be going from country to country asking people,
will you please like me?
For the song
and skits
from
G-Zero
Media,
Quintren
and Muse,
Pussycat,
Patsy
Cline,
and
Golden Earring,
and thanks to
Rod Serling, Rudy Giuliani, Cartman, Richard Nixon, Darth Vader,
Jimmy
Kimmel, Mikey
Day,
Jim
Carrey,
Kate
McKinnon, Alec Baldwin,
Jack,
Oliver Seth Myers, Stephen Colbert, Jeb Bush, John LaPook,
and
Anthony Fauci.
preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.
For some reason or another, you sound a little taller on radio.
You have tuned into the River Newsroom's Hudson Valley Coronavirus Report from Lissa Harris of The River and Roger Hannigan-Gilson of The Other Hudson Valley. Go to theotherhudsonvalley.com or therivernewsroom.com for more information and links to the stories included here. This report is a collaboration with several Hudson Valley journalists, airing on WGXC 90.7 FM at midnight, 5 7 and 9 a.m. and online in the audio archives at WGXC.org. La Voz, a Spanish language news magazine covering the Hudson Valley, is translating these roundups and co-publishing them on its website in Spanish at lavoz.bard.edu.
Under Governor Andrew Cuomo's leadership, New York State has made a habit of refusing to release important pandemic data, from nursing home fatalities to PPE stockpiling. In its latest transparency fail, the Cuomo administration won't release data on usage of the state's new COVID-19 smartphone app, the Times Union reports. Meanwhile, state officials in Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey, where similar contact tracing apps have been rolled out, are sharing data or making plans to do so. Times Union reporters are clearly getting tired of having their freedom of information request delayed and denied. Quote, Cuomo administration's unwillingness to share the public data is part of a pattern by the governor's office on releasing data during the ongoing public health crisis, unquote, they write. In an October 15th event promoting his new book, Cuomo told Bravo TV producer Andy Cohen that the state might look at legalizing recreational marijuana to alleviate some of its budget crisis. Quote, we need revenue and we're going to be searching the cupboards for revenue, and I think that is going to put marijuana over the top, unquote, Cuomo said. For perspective, California brought in about $637 million in marijuana tax revenues in 2019. New York's budget hole for the 2020 fiscal year is somewhere north of $14 billion. Outbreaks in small areas of New York State, where Cuomo administration has deployed a new strategy of strict neighborhood-level restrictions to keep infections from spreading, are currently responsible for almost 50% of hospitalizations in the state, according to a press release from Cuomo's office on October 23rd. The most recent data on the microclusters where outbreaks are occurring shows that the areas in Broome, Steuben, and Chemung counties have higher positivity rates than outbreak neighborhoods in New York City and Rockland and Orange counties, where positivity rates have been falling. Overall, hospitalizations for COVID-19 in New York State are above 1,000 for the first time since June. New York State's new strategy for suppressing outbreaks treats urban and rural areas differently, with higher case count positivity rate thresholds for taking action to stamp out outbreaks in more rural counties. State officials haven't said much about why New York is treating urban outbreaks as more dangerous than rural ones, but we'll note that there isn't a straightforward relationship between population density and COVID-19 transmission. Last month, Scientific American ran an interesting article delving into the complexity of the issue. Scientists are still getting a handle on the factors that drive community transmission, but things like the size of households and the interconnections between communities appear to be more important than raw population density in driving risk for rapid spread. In neighboring New Jersey, where cases are reaching levels not seen since May, officials are warning that much of the transmission is currently being driven by small private gatherings in people's homes. Quote, the capacities that we believe are contributing to the bulk of the new cases are those gatherings that are beyond our ability to regulate and properly enforce, unquote, Governor Phil Murphy said recently. Early in the pandemic, rapid community transmission in New York City gave the rest of the state and the rest of the nation the impression that COVID-19 is a city problem. The opposite is now true. Rural cases have climbed to perilous heights across the country, and the rural rate of infection has surpassed the urban rate nationwide, the Daily Yonder reports. On October 23rd, the U.S. hit its highest case count of the pandemic. With cases now far more geographically spread out across the country, the nation is poised to enter the worst stretch of the pandemic yet, the Washington Post reports. The economic crisis caused by the pandemic has wiped out more jobs than the Great Depression and the Great Recession combined. In an effort to capture the human cost, the New York Times partnered with local news outlets on a project called Out of Work in America, featuring a dozen people from around the country who are struggling to stay afloat. Quote, I feel like I'm on the cusp of losing everything is just pure frustration, unquote, 26-year-old Tucson sommelier Oscar Eligio Sanez said. Quote, I've got past the point of desperation, past the point of anger, and I just feel hopeless. I feel lost, unquote. Researchers are watching how masks work in real time. An ingenious study from Carnegie Mellon used Facebook's huge reach to survey people across the country and found a strong correlation between lower levels of mask wearing and higher levels of active illness at the state level. In other mask news, universal mask wearing could save 130,000 lives in the U.S. by spring. Researchers from the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation found in a study released October 23rd. Should we wipe down our groceries? Do we really need to quarantine library books? The best science we have on COVID-19 says probably not. Touching things like doorknobs and countertops is nowhere near as risky as breathing each other's air indoors. Wired weighed in this week on the great fomite freakout and how our worries about contaminated surfaces have misdirected our focus away from situations that are much more dangerous. Quote, I think that one thing that has been tough about this pandemic is there has been such a strong initial message that gave people the wrong intuition, unquote, Princeton biologist Dylan Morris told the magazine. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration issued an approval on October 22nd for the use of remdesivir to treat COVID-19. Remdesivir is the first COVID-19 treatment to get a full, not emergency approval from the agency. Unfortunately, the drug is looking less effective than researchers initially hoped in light of recent data. Also at the FDA, regulators may be getting cold feet about issuing an emergency use authorization for a COVID-19 vaccine, Stat reports. The worry is that an emergency use authorization, a tool that the agency has used to fast-track the use of potential COVID-19 treatments before the agency has a full picture of their effectiveness, might put an early halt to vaccine trials. Quote, the fear is that early authorization of vaccines could squander a one-time chance to determine how well the various vaccines work and which work best in whom, unquote, Helen Branswell writes. The agency is mulling the use of expanded access instead, a program that might stand a better chance of allowing trials to continue even while the vaccine is being administered. Local Congressperson Antonio Delgado, a Democrat representing New York's 19th district, is backing a bill that, with bipartisan support, that calls for a federal study on how to prevent the spread of COVID-19 in nursing homes. Nursing home infections have become an intensely political issue in New York State, where Governor Cuomo enacted and later rolled back a controversial policy directing nursing homes to take in COVID-19 positive residents, and where the state has refused to release data on how many nursing home residents have died in hospitals during the course of the pandemic. Early voting starts October 24th in New York State. You can find your early voting sites and all kinds of stuff on your Board of Elections website for each county. New York State also announced 8 additional companies in the state will start producing equipment and supplies to support New York's fight against the pandemic. The manufacturing will be supported by $4.9 million in grant funding from the state. 3 of the companies are in the Hudson Valley, Altor Safety, Georgia Brown, and Zile. 21 more bars and restaurants have had their liquor licenses suspended for, quote, egregious violations of coronavirus-related regulations, unquote. 3 are in the river's coverage area, El Nuevo Yomas Tavern in Port Chester, the La Batella Bar and Restaurant in Newburgh, and the La Bohemia Restaurant in Mount Vernon. Now the region-by-region roundup, starting with the lower Hudson Valley, where Putnam County issued another public health alert for a possible COVID-19 exposure, its third this week. Anyone who worked at or visited the Patterson Auto Body in Patterson on October 12th or to October 23rd may have been exposed. Some schools in East Ramapo will start hybrid learning on this Monday, October 26th, the district announced, but only those schools outside the red and yellow cluster enforcement zones. LowHUD.com writes that the decision to allow some students back into classrooms follows the revelation that nearly 40% of East Ramapo public school students were, quote, chronically absent, unquote, and another 15% were considered, quote, at risk, unquote. Westchester County Executive George Latimer's State of the County address delivered October 22nd was predictably heavy on the pandemic. Latimer recapped how the county had responded to the virus and reiterated recovery initiatives such as the Community Build Back Program and the Red Rent Help Project. He ended on an optimistic note, quote, the state of our county is fierce, unquote, Latimer said, fierce. Mid-Hudson Valley, the number of active cases in Columbia County has nearly doubled in the past week. County health officials are worried about community spread. At the Ghent Assisted Living Facility on Route 66, 27 residents and 9 staffers have tested positive. And 16 staff members and 3 youth at the Columbia Girls Secure Center and Brookwood Secure Center, both in Claverick, have also tested positive. 10 of the staffers live outside Columbia County and are not counted in its official statistics. Quote, not only does this outbreak involve county residents, but there are also a significant number of out-of-county residents who have tested positive who went home at the end of their workday, unquote, said County Health Director Jack Mabb. Quote, they stopped by the gas station, pharmacy, and the grocery store. They could very well have been contagious before they were actually tested. This is how the virus gets into the community, unquote. The Columbia County Department of Health will host 3 more COVID-19 testing clinics at the former John L. Edwards Primary School in Hudson. Those are from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. on November 10th, November 17th, and December 1st. Pre-registration is not required. Orange County Executive Steve Newhouse said in his October 23rd briefing that at least 2 nursing homes in the county have active positive cases. In the Catskills, results are still coming in from widespread testing of state prison inmates in Greene County, where an outbreak has caused cases to spike dramatically. On Friday, October 23rd, 31 new positive cases were announced among inmates in the Greene Correctional Facility, Greene County health officials said on a social media post. There are currently 21 known active cases outside the prison in Greene County. Sullivan County is seeing a spike in cases. Known active cases in the county have jumped from the mid-30s earlier in the week to 60 as of October 23rd. The county also issued a potential exposure warning on October 22nd for the auto zone on Route 52 in Liberty. Sullivan County Public Health and BOCES officials will host a virtual Zoom forum for the local school community to ask questions about COVID-19, 6 p.m. November 4th. To ask a question, send an email to publichealth.forum@scboces.org. COVID-19 in Delaware County is on an uptick with 4 new cases reported on October 22nd and another 4 on October 23rd. The county currently has 16 known cases, 3 of whom are hospitalized. The Shire Pub in Delhi announced on Facebook on October 22nd that one of their employees tested positive, and that restaurant will be closed through the end of the month. Delaware County Public Health shared a post from the restaurant, but county officials have not included any warnings about possible public exposure at the restaurant in their recent press release. The 3 new cases were found in Schoharie County on October 22nd after a week with only 1 new case, according to New York State data. The Schoharie County Department of Health has not yet issued a release about the new case. And this has been the Coronavirus Report from the River Newsroom. Go to therivernewsroom.com for more information about anything in this report.
Nope.
Give us a little wave.
One.
My waxed up hair and my painted shoes. Got an offer that you might refuse. Tonight, we're gonna take a stab. Come on along, we'll grab a cab. There ain't much to look at, so close your eyes, here we go. We're playing at the talent show. Playing at the talent show. Come on along, here we go. Playing at the talent show. Check us out, here we go. Playing at the talent show.
Yo, Pitt.
Well, we got our guitars and we got our fun picks. And we're going on after some lips and chicks. We're feeling good from the pills we took.
Hey, this is Rowan from Copic, and you are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, broadcasting in Acre, Catskill, Hudson, and more. Listener-supported hands-on radio for Greene and Columbia counties.
Tune in WGXC's new Sunday morning schedule with the Reverend Kim Singletary and There's a Bright Side Somewhere every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. That's followed by the teens from Hudson talking about books they've read on Bound by Books after the local news at 9 a.m. And at 10 a.m., there's more teens. The Catskill kids from Clubhouse Radio are on at 10 a.m. with lots of music and talk on your community radio station, WGXC.org, 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Justin of Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
90.7 FM.
Acre, Hudson, Catskill.
Trump's lies take lives. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. All governments lie. Those are the words of the legendary independent journalist I.F. Stone in 1965, critiquing official U.S. statements on the so-called progress of the Vietnam War. He added, speaking of President Lyndon Johnson, quote, "It's dangerous to trust anything he says," unquote. Half a century later, President Donald Trump is taking lying to a whole new level. The Washington Post fact checker documented 22,247 Trump lies during his first term through late August. When asked why the pace of Trump's lies has increased over the course of his presidency, journalist Daniel Dale, CNN's full-time Trump fact checker, replied, "He's talking more." The deadly consequences of Trump's lies have been laid bare by the coronavirus pandemic. With less than 5% of the world's population, the United States has 20% of the world's COVID-19 infections and deaths, more than 8.3 million infected people, and over 220,000 deaths. How is it possible the world's richest country, with public health institutions that were, until recently, the gold standard globally, could fail so tragically? Much of the blame falls squarely on Donald Trump, who's lied from the start about this ever-worsening COVID catastrophe.
"We have it totally under control."
Those are the words of President Trump boasting on January 22nd. On February 7th, Trump told journalist Bob Woodward the coronavirus was...
"It's also more deadly than your, you know, your even your strenuous flus. You know, people don't realize we lose 25,000, 30,000 people a year here. Who would ever think that, right?"
"I know. It's
it's pretty amazing." "And then I say, well, is that the same thing?
For
this is more deadly. This is 5% versus 1% and less than 1%. You know, so this is deadly stuff."
Yet he publicly repeated,
"Miraculously goes away."
Trump claimed,
"Anybody that needs a test gets a test. They're there. They have the test."
An absolute lie. Across the country, there's been a devastating lack of access to tests, masks, and other PPE, that's personal protective equipment, with no coherent federal pandemic response. A Columbia University study published this week blames, quote, "the abject failures of U.S. government policies for anywhere from 130,000 to 210,000 preventable COVID-19 deaths in the U.S., based on comparisons to other countries that have fared far better." Almost all states are now experiencing a sustained surge, with a national average of over 60,000 new COVID-19 cases per day and almost 1,000 daily deaths. Many states now being hit the hardest are those with Trump-allied governors who repeated his lies, refusing to impose mask mandates, forcing schools to reopen, and aggressively pushing bars and restaurants to open without restriction. The coronavirus doesn't just strike geographically. It impacts different communities differently, exposing inequality and racism. More than 2 million U.S. prisoners are trapped in close quarters, usually without access to basic protections against COVID-19 infections, masks, hand hygiene, social distancing, and adequate ventilation. The New York Times reports at least 242,000 people, including prisoners, guards, and other staff, have been infected in prisons and jails in the U.S., and at least 1,400 have died. On Tuesday, a court in California ordered the state to reduce the prisoner population of its notorious maximum security San Quentin prison by half through transfers or parole. Three-quarters of the prisoner population at San Quentin has tested positive so far. 28 of them have died. But while dismissing or downplaying these terrible statistics, Trump does care about some numbers. TV ratings, for example. Although he lost in the ratings matchup with Joe Biden in the recent dueling town halls broadcast on different networks simultaneously, Trump cares about crowd sizes, from forcing his press secretary to lie about his inaugural crowd on the first full day of his presidency to exaggerating the size of his crowds at his current spate of rallies, where his fans gather shoulder to shoulder, mostly without masks. One figure that Trump must hate is the record-shattering number of people voting early. People want to avoid crowded polling places during the pandemic or are concerned by Republican efforts to suppress the vote and want to ensure their ballot is submitted and counted without being challenged or discarded. These early votes are widely believed to favor Joe Biden over Trump. The latest figures indicate over 43 million people have already voted. In recent weeks, as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to scourge the U.S. and the world, Trump has repeated yet another lie. We're rounding the curve, he says. He sounds like General Westmoreland, commander of the U.S. forces in Vietnam during the Johnson administration, who lied that there was light at the end of the tunnel. Journalist I.F. Stone regularly shredded the lies told by Westmoreland and other architects of that disastrous war, documenting the deceptions in his famous weekly newsletter. As Trump continues to lie about voter fraud, saying the election is being rigged against him, a bipartisan cross-section of U.S. society, from mass movements to the political establishment, has converged to defeat him and to send him a clear message: the truth hurts. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
German measles, Russian flu, Montezuma's revenge. And why do we say a foreign word whenever someone sneezes?
Tomorrow, I'll take a look at swine flu, up close and personal. This is Les Nesbitt.
I'm Tom Rowe, and WGXE has been trying to tell all sorts of stories about this election locally so you can make your decision at the polls from now until November 3rd. Here's WGXC's Philip Grant with some WGXC election news.
Emily Munson and Edward McKinley report in the Times Union that Representative Antonio Delgado, a Democrat from Rhinebeck, would seemingly be facing long odds for re-election this November. He's running in a district, New York 19th, that has been held by Republicans for 22 of the previous 26 years. The district voted for Donald Trump in 2016 by almost 7 points. But the Cook Political Report rates his election as, and I quote, likely Democratic, end quote. And he has a giant fundraising advantage against four opponents. Delgado is running against Green Party candidate Stephen Greenfield, Libertarian Victoria Alexander, and Republicans Kyle Vandewater and Ola Hawatme. Delgado has limited his appearances with the media and stopped holding open town hall meetings, instead letting the Republicans fight amongst themselves. Vandewater beat Hawatme in the Republican primary, but she has launched a write-in campaign that will surely siphon votes from the Republican line on the ballot. Delgado has raised $5.6 million for the election, and Vandewater has raised $50,000. For Hawatme, a group of Republicans are raising money but not reporting campaign finance figures. Trump, so far, has not endorsed Vandewater. Republicans have been infighting since before the primary election. A According to a screenshot obtained by the Times Union, Greene County Republican Chairman Brent Bogardus texted Hawatme in April, and I quote, "Understand this. You can take your money and stick it up your ass. You have done great harm by pursuing your personal agenda instead of choosing to be a team player. I personally could give a flying rat's ass if you win this primary that you forced. You will never receive any support from me," end quote. The 200 Republicans calling themselves the old guard don't agree and continue to back Hawatme. Brian LaRusso, a Republican from Otsego County, said, and I quote, "Watching what they did to her, from calling her a Muslim to saying we'll never vote for a Middle Easterner, my own party showed me that in many ways the Democrats were right. They're a bunch of racist idiots. It was upsetting," end quote. Fox News host Sean Hannity tweeted last week, and I quote, "The way New York CD19 has been handled is an absolute disgrace. I hope people are aware of the hashtag write in Oluwatme option. This is why I am registered conservative in New York," end quote. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Raymond Pignon is reporting for Columbia Green Media on the two candidates competing for the open seat on the Durham Town Board in the November election. Republicans are running Lisa M. Cirillo. Cirillo, 60, moved upstate in 2001 and lived in Oak Hill until 2008 when she moved to East Durham. She was employed by the Office of the Comptroller as an Employees Retirement Systems Examiner. This is her first bid for elected office. Cirillo defines economic development as the top issue facing the community. She currently serves on the Committee for Economic Development. She claims a good fit for town board because of her government experience. Cirillo says, and I quote, "I have worked in local and state government for almost 20 years. I look forward to being a voice of the people in our town and helping them to accomplish what they believe needs to be changed. In my capacity as community member for economic development, I hope to help bring a much-needed medical facility to our town," end quote. Lifetime East Durham resident Brianna Rustick, 20, is running on the Democrat line, will graduate from the College of St. Rose in December with a degree in criminal justice. Rustick ran for the Durham Town Board in 2019. She said, and I quote, "One of the issues facing the town of Durham right now is the issue of broadband and cell service. Especially in this time during COVID-19, with lots of things moving online, such as school and work. It has been really hard for a majority of town residents because they have had to utilize the wireless internet from various businesses in town," end quote. Rustick said it is doubly hard for the younger members of the community because they also lack the transportation needed to get to locations where Wi-Fi is available, end quote. Rustick said she would be a good choice for the town board, and I quote, "because I'm different than what has been the typical council member. Not only am I younger, but I am a different political party than the other members. I think this would not only be a perfect way to get the different generations of the town to work together, but also to make people aware that those of different political parties can work together to make Durham the best it can be," end quote. Read more at HudsonValley360.com. Melanie Lekasevic is reporting for Columbia Green Media. Voters in the town of Kinderhook will choose between two candidates to fill a vacancy on the town board. The names of the Republican and Independence candidate Deborah Johnson and Melissa Miller, a candidate on the Kinderhook United and Democratic Party, will be on the ballot. Johnson, 56, was appointed to fill the seat left open when board member Patsy Leader was elected town supervisor in 2019. Johnson previously served on the board from 2011 to 2009 and was deputy supervisor from 2007 to 2009. She is a lifelong resident of Columbia County. Johnson is employed by the SMPR Title Agency, where she has worked for more than 21 years. Johnson is a graduate of Hudson Valley Community College. Public safety and infrastructure are her key issues in her campaign. Johnson said, and I quote, "Right now, keeping residents safe throughout the COVID-19 pandemic is top priority. Working to obtain funds for the repair of town roads needs to also be a priority," end quote. Melissa Miller, 38, has lived in Columbia County for 18 years and is a resident of Valencia. She works as a pet sitter and dog walker. Miller holds an associate degree from the SUNY Canton and a bachelor's from the SUNY Potsdam. Communication within the community is the biggest issue she wants to address if elected. Miller said, and I quote, "Residents of Kinderhook have the right to know what our elected officials are doing for us and the town. By using additional tools such as social media posts, an e-newsletter, monthly posts in our local newspapers, and a low-cost printed newsletter for folks without computer access or knowledge, we can further expand the ways in which the town ensures all residents have access to the information they need," end quote. Miller hopes to bring a fresh, people-centered approach to the town council. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Raymond Pignon is reporting for Columbia Green Media on the Lexington Town Board race between Republican Susan Falk Turk and Democrat Bennett Wine. Wine was elected last year to serve out the last year of the unexpired term of a former board member. Falk Turk, 50, finished second in that election last year. She was born and raised in Lexington and has taken care of her grandparents and uncle and now her mother and father at the family farmhouse. Her grandparents began their life together at the home where she now lives. Falk Turk has been employed as a head teller at a bank in Ulster County for 15 years. If elected, she will hold public office for the first time. She's a 1992 graduate of SUNY Cobleskill, where she received an associate degree in office technology word processing. Falk Turk defines the top issues facing Lexington as, and I quote, business, end quote. She said, and I quote, "We have to travel to other towns for gas, groceries, or takeout. We have several travelers coming to town for hiking, fishing, hunting, and then traveling back out of town to spend money in other communities. I would like to see more opportunities for revenue and jobs in our town," end quote. Falk Turk said if elected, she looks forward to serving the communities she grew up in. She said, and I quote, "I know most of the residents, and I will work hard with the rest of the town council to make Lexington a great place to live, work, and enjoy life in," end quote. Wine, 65, and his family live on Mock Drive in Westkill. He has lived in Greene County for 12 years. He is an artist and designer. Wine graduated from Columbia University with a Master's of Fine Art degree and from Antioch College with a Bachelor's degree in art. Wine served as co-chair of the Lexington Broadband Initiative. He said, and I quote, "This was a huge step in bringing Lexington into the future. Since then, our growth has started and we are beginning to get young families with children to come to our town. With the advent of COVID-19, more people have seen the advantages of living and working from our town, and I would assume the growth will continue. Now the challenge is how to best adapt the town to the changing situation and at the same time keep the things that we love about the town intact," end quote. Wine said he would be a good choice because, and I quote, "I have been a good board member because I have a vision for the town and I have been acting on it," end quote. You can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Sean Mulkerin in the Altamont Enterprise profiles the four candidates who want to be elected in New York's 46th Senate District. Democrat Michelle Hinchey, Republican Richard Amador, Green Party candidate Robert Alft, and write-in candidate Gary Greenberg. Hinchey is from Saugerties and is the daughter of Maurice Hinchey, who once represented the area in Congress. Conservative Richard Amador is a resident of Rensselaerville and a longtime member of the town's planning board. Alft is a Voorheesville resident, and Greenberg is a Greene County resident who mounted an unsuccessful campaign in the Democrats' primary. The district covers all of Greene County and parts of Ulster, Albany, Schenectady, and Montgomery counties. Hinchey has received 1,766 contributions, totaling $446,000. Amador has received 113 donations, totaling $90,847. Greenberg's $19,926 came from 52 different contributors, but $12,500 came from Greenberg himself. The Altamont Enterprise did not report any campaign fundraising information from Alt, and there does not seem to be any information on New York's website. Amador is from Rensselaerville in Albany County and recently retired from the New York State Police after 31 years. He was the head of the Troopers Union the last 4 years of his tenure. Amador said, and I quote, "Taxes are too high in New York. We need to be fiscally responsible in good times so that when we do have emergencies, we can weather the storm, so to speak," end quote. Henchy graduated from Cornell in 2009 and worked in communications for 10 years and helped on Antonio Delgado's 2018 campaign for Congress. Henchy is interested in reforming the property tax system. She said, and I quote, "Right now, owning property, we're penalized," end quote. Many people who make less are paying more in property taxes than people who live in cities, according to Henchy. Greenberg is from New Baltimore in Greene County, is known for working for several years for the passage of the Child Victims Act and Aaron's Law. Greenberg is interested in New York raising additional revenue from sports gaming online. He says New Yorkers are, and I quote, "crossing the border with their phones," end quote, to bet on sporting events online while New York State is missing out on hundreds of millions in tax revenue. Alp lives in Voorheesville and drove a bus for the school district there from the year 2000 to 2017. He says single-payer health care would be, and I quote, "a great thing for New York," end quote, and is also in favor of ranked choice voting. Read more about this story in the Altamont Enterprise. Republican State Senator Daphne Jordan of Half Moon has earned the Environmental Advocates Action 2020 Oil Slick Award. EA Action said in a press release, "The award is presented annually to a New York State lawmaker that has repeatedly voted against the environment and I quote, put the priorities of polluters ahead of public health and safety," end quote. Peter M. Iwanowitz, executive director of Environmental Advocates Action, said, and I quote, "Unfortunately, time and again, Senator Jordan turns her back on her constituents' health and safety and instead chooses to prop up polluters. During her short time in office, she has voted against measures that fight climate change, protect kids from toxic toys, and keep dangerous chemicals out of our food," end quote. In making the award, EA Action highlighted Jordan's vote to reject a bill to ban PFAS chemicals from food packaging, the same chemicals that contaminated the drinking water in Hoosick Falls. EA Action wrote, and I quote, "Voting no means standing with polluting corporations that profit while the public gets sick. Senator Daphne Jordan sided with the polluters, not her constituents," end quote. Jordan's predecessor and former boss, then-Senator Kathy Marchione, earned the Oil Slick Award in 2014. Republican State Senator George Amador tied with Jordan with the lowest score in the Senate, scoring a 49 out of 100 according to the 2020 Environmental Scorecard. In the Assembly, Republican Jake Ashby scored a 77 out of 100. Democrat D.D. Barrett received a 100 for the second year in a row, and Republican Christopher Teague scored a 52, up from 43 last year. The Environmental Scorecard tracks the votes of every state legislator on environmental legislation. Environmental Advocates Action was founded in 1969. It is the sister organization of Environmental Advocates New York, and you can read more at xaction.org. Edward McKinley is reporting for Capital Confidential. Albany County Sheriff Craig Apple, October 13th, endorsed state senator candidate Michelle Henchy. Henchy, a Democrat, is running for the 46th district seat in a field of four candidates that includes Republican Richard Amador, Green Party candidate Robert Alf Jr., and write-in candidate Gary Greenberg. Amador is a former state trooper. Incumbent George Amador is not running for re-election. Apple said in an announcement distributed by Henchy's office, and I quote, "In a time of so much division, we need leaders who bring people together, have the tough conversations, and find the best pathways forward for all of us. She is the kind of state senator we need and who will fight to serve everyone in our region," end quote. Read more about this story at Capital Confidential, a Times Union blog.
one speeding ticket in Columbia County.
Columbia County, everybody gets speeding tickets. How else do they pay for the roads to get plowed in the winter?
Now here's your weekend forecast. On Saturday, a slight chance of showers between 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. Otherwise, it will be partly sunny with a temperature high near 63 degrees. And then a mostly clear Saturday night with a temperature low of around 35 degrees. And on Sunday, sunny with a high near 51 degrees. And Sunday night, a chance of rain after 2 a.m. It will be mostly cloudy with a low of around 37 degrees. And that is your weather update from WGXC 90.7 FM radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia counties.
We're joined by Lee Harris, who is the managing editor for New York Focus. Welcome to the show, Lee.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
So New York Focus is a relatively new publication. Can you tell our listeners what it is?
Yeah, that's right. We're an in-depth investigative journalism publication on New York state and local politics, really looking to fill a kind of gap that I think has been felt for a really long time in the New York media ecosystem since, I mean, most sort of devastatingly since Village Voice shuttered. But looking to shed light on New York state politics generally through really strong investigative coverage.
And when you say in-depth investigative coverage of, you know, New York state politics, what are you talking about?
So yeah, that means a whole range of things. I think actually the stories that we launched with in our first issue, which it's hard to believe was a week and a half ago, it kind of sums up the span of pieces we're trying to produce. We had everything from a look at how city pension funds are subsidizing firms like Blackstone and other private equity real estate and are being outperformed by the market, which was a kind of, you know, wonky look at city politics and the way in which the controller's record is maybe inconsistent with some of the more progressive claims he's made on the campaign trail, to an in-depth policy explainer on the stock transfer tax, which is one of these new tax the rich proposals that's gaining some steam but also facing a lot of resistance. And I could go more in depth on either of those and a number of other stories we've published, but yeah, I guess the at the most general level, we want to write really in-depth feature stories on the kinds of issues that kind of 24-hour news cycle doesn't really permit reporters to dig into.
So who's your target audience for New York Focus?
Yeah, I mean, in some respects, we're still toying with that or having that discussion, because I think there's such a hunger for this kind of journalism among advocates and policymakers and people who work in politics. And I think also there's such an energized activism movement just across the state. Our sort of first layer of readership, I think, is just people who are already really engaged in New York politics. But I also think there's much deeper interest in state level political issues that don't get covered by newspapers that have sort of pivoted towards a more national model. So we're really trying to write for all New Yorkers and make New York's legislative process more transparent to them. I mean, the kind of thing I keep coming back to is just a feeling that, you know, as a New Yorker myself, I was reading existing coverage, and there would just be sort of passing mentions of really opaque legislative processes in Albany that, even though I felt like I kind of followed New York politics pretty closely just as a resident, I had no idea what they meant, and they usually sounded too boring to look into myself. And so I think for people who are, yeah, we want to be read by people who are interested in New York politics, but